Hello, welcome to The Sound of Economics with Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic policy think tank. My name is Sean Gibson, I'm Bruegel's press officer, and today we're here for another instalment in the Deep Focus podcast series, which, if you're unfamiliar with the format, is where we have a conversation with Bruegel scholars about the research that they've put together. We try to distill the key findings. Joining me for this episode is Bruegel's senior fellow, Scott Marcus. Hello, Scott.
Hello.
Thank you for joining me. You've co-written a research paper for the European Parliament looking at the benefits of the digital single market for Europe and the successes and perhaps less successful measures of the European Commission's strategy in that direction since 2015. And more broadly, the paper also touches on how the digital single market ties in with the digitization of European society. So if we can possibly begin with the ideal that we have in mind when we're talking about the digital single market, and what is the overall point? Why are we pursuing a digital single market?
The digital single market originates in a strategy that the European Commission put forward in 2015. They were trying to achieve a number of different goals, but most of them revolve around two main themes. One of them is about facilitation of cross-border electronic commerce, e-commerce. The idea is that it should be as easy to buy online goods from a different member state as it is to buy it in your own member state. I'll come back in a moment on why that's an issue. The other is broadly promotion of the digital society, and that involves a number of elements. In terms of electronic communications, it means better broadband, better mobile services, eventually 5G. But in other areas of information and communication technologies, it means promotion of technologies like artificial intelligence, machine learning, big data, the Internet of Things, maybe blockchain, and a few others. So there's really a lot of different moving parts in this digital single market strategy. Now, you'd asked a bit about how successful it was. Actually, I would have to say the measures generally make sense. The overall package really does address genuine problems that were identified in surveys of consumers and merchants, mostly in sensible ways. Many of them perhaps don't go far enough. It's likely that we'll need a second round to deal with some issues in some areas. But by and large, it was a sensible set of initiatives. But it's not one piece of legislation. It's about 30-some-odd, maybe 37 in my study. There's a lot to it.
So, you talk about several different pieces of legislation. And you've talked about the elements of success. So what have the gains been so far that you've found, and which measures have you found to be the most successful?
Some of them produce more benefits than others. Some of them are likely to be more successful than others. It's a little early to judge definitely how good the measures are. Many of them were just implemented. Not all of them are even in effect yet. Even the ones that are in effect haven't had long enough to be there, so we can't take actual measurements. Most of them are likely to do something, though. The work done on electronic communications regulation seems to be quantitatively the biggest. It's likely to promote more fast broadband in the member states. We have gaps in a number of member states. I was just in Italy a few days ago. It's historically been a bit of a problem case. It's coming along. It's actually better than it was a few years back. Here, the idea of facilitating investment and eliminating blockages to it makes sense, and quantitatively actually is one of the highest gain efforts of the measure. Another that looks to be fairly big in terms of the economic consequences are measures to free up public sector data for use. And that's expected not only to enable new businesses, but also to help the public sector itself to use its own data better. So the measures broadly make sense. A large bunch, again, deal with cross-border e-commerce. And they need to be understood best, I think, as a package. They're trying to make consumer protection, value-added tax, a parcel delivery across borders within the EU, all of these things easier for the merchants, more effective, more cost-effective. And to the extent that that promotes better cross-border e-commerce, online sales, that's helpful. A very good study that was done by the European Commission's Joint Research Center looked at what the effects would be if we could get a full price convergence across the member states of the EU so that goods would really look like a single market across the different member states. And they found that online goods prices should drop on average about 1% for goods and about 0.5% for offline sale of goods as well. Think about that for a second. That means that the competition from the online world drives more price convergence even in offline sales. So it's an interesting result. Now, normally in these kind of things, when you see a policy measure driving prices down, usually that's great for the consumers, not so good for the producers. Here they actually found benefits a bit over 1% for consumers and also a bit over 1% for the producers, mostly because even though the cost of the goods themselves would be reduced, meaning less profit in that sense, but the cost to the merchant would also be less because selling them online is less expensive than selling them offline. So it looks surprisingly win-win in the results, and this is the goal. I don't think the measures that were done to date will get us anything like all the way there, but they're in the right direction, and they're all directionally sensible.
Yeah, so you've already made mention of the fact that we might need a second round with the digital single market, and you've said that we're not all the way there yet. Is in this paper that you've co-written, you look at gains that can still be made, and just wondered if you could elaborate on that for us, and particularly which areas are realistically where we might make the most ground in the years to come.
Well, there's a lot here. First, there's the whole promotion of new technology. But second, there's sort of finishing up the unfinished business in the current package. There are a couple of measures that conspicuously don't go as far as I think they needed to go. And I don't fault the institutions here. They're dealing with genuinely hard problems. The first one that I'd flag is the one about parcel delivery. Now, one might very well say, what's parcel delivery doing in this package in the first place? This is about digital. But of course, about half of the online commerce is for goods, not services. And those goods have to get where they're going, and generally that means they have to be shipped. What the research tells us is that shipment cross-border costs anywhere from 3 to 5 times as much as shipment within a given member state, and that has not very much to do with real costs. It's probably helpful for the postal services. They have a genuine problem trying to cover their existing delivery routes at a time when volumes of letters are going down. But it's still unhelpful for e-commerce if those prices are artificially inflated to levels way above cost. So the Commission undertook some measures to try to improve transparency, to strengthen the postal regulatory authorities, and to drive prices down. Generally, the measures on transparency are the ones that got enacted. The most important bits to drive prices down didn't get through, probably member state opposition. Again, there's some grounds to be nervous about this, but something actually has to happen and probably will need to happen in the next legislative term. Another area where the measure didn't go as far as it needed to, despite the fact in this case that I was working closely with the Parliament and I know they wanted to go further on this, is the area of geo-blocking. Geo-blocking is a prohibition against various measures that would hinder cross-border sales. And the blocking itself can take place at any of 4 stages. It can take place either because the user can't get access to the website or gets forcibly redirected to a website in a different country. It can happen because the user isn't accepted by the website. It can happen because the user can't get the goods shipped, or it can happen because the user can't pay. So different kinds of geo-blocking, the regulation tries to deal with all of them, deals with most of them pretty sensibly. But there's omissions in the regulation as enacted, and they're big ones. For goods, the omission relates to goods that require shipment. So you can, it essentially forces merchants to respond at least to passive sales, not to actively market, but to respond at least to passive requests to purchase, provided that the user can pick the goods up themselves in some country where the merchant normally does business. Now, the compulsion to here, the issue really has to do with forcing the merchant to sell in a country where the merchant wouldn't choose to sell. And the reasons why merchants choose not to sell abroad are numerous. Some of them relate to value-added tax differences, to consumer protection differences. The merchant has to know all of these things. For a big merchant like Amazon, that's not a big deal. They do that every day in lots of countries. For a small merchant, it can be a big deal. The transaction costs can be a substantial factor for a small business. And also, there can be safety requirements, packaging requirements, a multitude of issues that the merchant has to be prepared to deal with. Now, supposedly, we have mutual recognition in the European Union. So you would think that these things should all be dealt with through mutual recognition, but they aren't in practice. And perhaps more important, the small merchants can't be confident that they're dealt with in practice in all cases. So the measure that was enacted doesn't require shipment cross-border. And it was probably sensible to stop at that point, at least on the first round, and see how things work. But eventually it needs to go further because almost all goods, in fact, do have to be shipped. And so the measure as it is will have limited effect on goods. It does more for services, but there it has a different exclusion for a different reason. What we really want, most of us, is to be able to see our videos when we're traveling. And some measures have been taken already with portability of videos, but this is sort of the big one. And we all have been in positions, I'm sure, where we wanted to watch a sport broadcast and couldn't watch it. And it's doggone irritating. Now, there are reasons why this is done. The biggest reason has to do with funding of the audiovisual productions in the first place. Funding in Europe comes from multiple sources. Some of it comes from government subsidies. A lot of it comes from pre-funding. And normally, for a distribution channel for video to contribute to that funding, they have to know that they got exclusivity in some territory. What this means is that the territorial exclusivity that's part of almost all licensing arrangements, well, large number of licensing arrangements, let me qualify, is really fundamental to getting the production created in the first place. And so if there were a blocking regulation put in place that prohibited geo-blocking, that would prevent this funding, and multiple studies have shown it would result in less cinema being produced, less audiovisual material being produced. That doesn't really help Europe. That doesn't help the common person in the street. So the Parliament, the Council, wisely stopped short of doing this. They considered it seriously. They were dying to do it, and with good reason. But it can't be solved in such a simple way. Now, to understand the problem, I think it's important to go back to the roots of how the European audiovisual industry is built in the first place. And here we find that most firms that create audiovisual content create it either for a single country or a single language market. Obviously, Austria, Germany, parts of Switzerland are still one market for this purpose. But that means that the rights are generally sold on that basis. The works are created on that basis. A relatively small fraction, in one survey it was 18%, of audiovisual content is created with the intent of cross-border sales. Now, different kinds of copyrighted media have different implications as regards language, right? Audiovisual, you can dub it, you can subtitle it, you can overvoice it. So it can be designed for multiple country use. And of course, when the Americans produce audiovisual media, they design it with a worldwide marketing plan from day one. That's part of the way that they do business. In Europe, our companies mostly don't. If you look at cinema box office receipts, which are really critical for Europe, something like 2/3 of those go to U.S. productions, and year after year, maybe only a quarter go to purely European productions. So something's wrong with this picture. You might immediately assume, well, we just don't produce as much as the Yanks. Sorry to say, that's not the case. In a typical year, Europe produces about 2.5 times as many feature films as Hollywood. So the fact that we get such low cross-border sales reflects structural deficiencies and marketing inefficiencies within Europe. You don't solve those, unfortunately, with the geo-blocking regime. You need to really tackle the structure of the industry. How to go about that is not obvious to me. I think it needs study. I don't believe this has ever been studied. I don't think anyone wanted to ask such a basic question. But I believe it's needed, and to take us to the next step, that's probably what's going to be required. Now, if we look at language issues, other kinds of copyrighted goods could be dealt with in this way. They weren't, perhaps because it was a little scary to try to deal with the different copyrighted goods in different ways. Music would be less of a problem, wouldn't have this problem. E-books have some special problems about minimum prices, but could be dealt with. And games actually seem to have very few blockages in the first place. Games basically are sold cross-border anyway. But in any case, for this geo-blocking, there is an opportunity to go further, but there are big changes that have to be done before it's going to make sense.
I think the geo-blocking is an excellent and relatable example that's related to the digital single market. We've talked a lot about goods. I just wondered if you could go into more detail about maybe the differences that your study found between goods and services, for example, with the implementation of the measures in the digital single market strategy.
Thank you. That's a good question. An awful lot of literature suggests that our single market, not just the digital single market, but overall, works much better for goods than it does for services, that we still have a rather broken single market for services. And so there, I would expect, actually, that measures that deal with services are going to be much more visible in the next legislative term. Now, the services are evolving, and I talked at the beginning about the importance of promoting new kinds of technologies, and I talked a bit about transmission technologies, 5G and broadband. But there's another entire leg of digital single market, mostly expressed in strategies rather than in legislation. And that deals with the promotion of things like artificial intelligence and big data, machine learning, maybe blockchain. So there, part of this has to do with funding, including research funding. Part of it has to do with concrete impediments as well. On the funding side, if you look at the amount of money that the United States is putting into artificial intelligence, mostly for defense purposes, it looks pretty big compared to the contributions, even with the increases that the Commission proposed making in May of 2018. The investments on the United States look large. It's a little hard to be sure what China is putting in, but the numbers look even larger there and will be used in many targeted ways that could really benefit the Chinese economy. So relative to our largest trading partners, we're at a substantial risk of falling behind in the funding war on some technologies that could be truly transformative. If you look at estimates from some of the experts, including some nice studies by McKinsey, for instance, they come up with potential gains from these technologies that are measured in trillions of euro per year. Now, that's a pretty big number. And so Europe doesn't want to miss out on this new wave of technology, which could transform the entirety of industry and society. And for that, making sure, first, that we have adequate levels of funding, second, that the diffusion models for getting that funding into real products and services happens, but also that we eliminate impediments as well. And a couple of those have already been identified. One that might sound small but might turn out to be very important has to do with liability. For the Internet of Things, when something breaks, who is responsible? Now, we've had these issues for a long time. We have a good set of liability rules for goods in Europe, but some of these new goods are doggone complex. We have cases with drones, for example. There was a pilot flying a drone. It crashed into a crane that wasn't supposed to be there. So the service that was registering what was there didn't show the crane where it happened to actually be. And so in a lot of cases, you get questions, who's actually got the responsibility? Was it the manufacturer of the drone? Was it the maker of the crane? Was it the data service that failed to register the crane? Who sues whom? How do you get redress? For goods, we have a so-called strict product liability regime where the user has to show that there was damage, but doesn't actually have to prove, and has to show that it was caused by something that the product did, but doesn't actually have to prove that there was malfeasance on the part of the company. That's felt to be a step too far. No normal consumer would be able to meet that standard of proof. When we get to these very complicated systems that are somehow a mix of goods and services, it becomes very difficult to judge where the responsibility is. And consider, again, in the machine learning case, supposing that an intelligent device comes up with a conclusion that is perhaps correct, but undesired, you know, where's the liability? Is it with the programmer? So these are things that are going to need to be sorted out and probably will be sorted out in the next legislative term. The commission has already started to look at these, but there are many unknowns in all of these areas. It'll have to evolve over time.
I wanted to ask you about how the digital single market strategy has tied into the broader digitization efforts of society in Europe, not just with these measures that we've seen enacted in this term, but the ones that are most realistically foreseeably implementable in the next legislative term. So, how well those have paired up?
I think the measures actually are all directionally right. They're trying to do the right things. In a lot of these areas, there are going to be additional steps, and in some cases, that's simply because the evolution of the technology isn't yet entirely clear. When we look at machine learning, when we look at artificial intelligence, they're likely to have huge impacts on the way that we do work and also on the number of jobs, the number of hours worked, the kind of hours worked, the degree of skill needed to do the work. All of these are going to change. So there are things that can't be predicted perfectly today. You know, quoting former U.S. Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, we have a lot of known unknowns, and we also have some unknown unknowns. So this is an area that's really very likely to evolve. At the same time, the movement's in the right direction. A natural question is, what's the digital single market likely to look like in the coming legislative term? And here, there's been a lot of discussion among the think tanks. An emerging realization is that there is today no non-digital single market. What part of the single market doesn't somehow get touched one way or another by digitization? So in that sense, it's quite possible that we won't have quite the same focus on a digital single market, but rather on the realization of a single market, together with a recognition of the importance of digitization as a whole. Digitization is needed. That's what all of these things that I've been talking about in regard to artificial intelligence and machine learning and Internet of Things and blockchain and whatever else, that's really what they're about. And so promotion of digitization and promotion of the single market are both likely to be major themes, but perhaps their linkage into a digital single market becomes less the focus for the next term.
Well, I think that about wraps things up for this episode. Thank you to everyone for tuning in for this deep focus, and thank you very much, Scott, for taking us through your research. If you'd like to hear more of Bruegel's work, we have a range of other podcast episodes, as well as our publications and blog posts, available on our website, www.bruegel.org. We hope you've enjoyed listening to The Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.